some more data?
Well, Mark Rodiger from the Center for UFO Studies is supposed to call this guy.
Uh-huh.
He, you know, it's kind of strange. We have his name and we have his phone number. Now, that's the only part that bugs me. Anybody that would stick his neck out there, if his deck is really wet, he's probably giving us a fictitious name and a bad phone number and all that.
Well, no, it could still be that the guy's telling you the truth as he perceives it. But it just ain't so.
Mm-hmm.
I started on this thing about 6:30 this morning.
I just got
reams of paper written here. I went and I pulled the logs, which are the official facility record of what transpires during that period of time. And I want to share...
Yeah, I want to get this on tape so I can type it down. Okay, go ahead.
I don't know if I can read you this to be taped.
Do what?
I don't know that I can read this to you to be taped.
Oh, okay.
I'll share it with you.
Okay, that's good.
But it's not public information.
Yeah.
Unless this Mark guy gets him a freedom of information.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we do tape things, I just use it for personal use only.
Okay.
I never violate that. Right. I promise you that.
Well, all right.
I've just got a terrible memory.
At 23:30 hours on 2 December 93. Now, that's Greenwich Mean Time.
Mm-hmm.
There was an air carrier, and I'm going to avoid using his call sign.
Okay.
Advised the King controller that they saw another aircraft, now I'm going to quote, smaller than an airliner, end of the quotes, approximately 2,000 feet above their altitude. Didn't see aircraft on TCAS, nor did we see aircraft on our radar.
Probably didn't have a transponder, right?
Right. Now TCAS, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but
I was going to ask you what that was.
It's airborne collision avoidance.
Oh.
That my airplane can see your airplane, and the two airplanes can work out a solution if they are both TCAS equipped, so they don't run into one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's predicated on operating transponder and operational mode C. Mode C being altitude information being transmitted, so that my airplane can see your transmitted altitude or your mode C, and your airplane can see mine. And then the two little computers in this TCAS system say, okay, Francis, you descend, and Bob, you climb. And that's how it works.
Hmm.
So this airliner, he did not have a TCAS response from the airplane he was looking at, which indicates that the transponder was non-operating, and our radar didn't see him, which indicates that the transponder was non-operating in that geographical area. Additional notes were made on the master log. That was from the control area down there. And the master log says that there were reported lights and a possible aircraft in the vicinity of this air carrier. Now, reading both of those statements, I don't seem to sense the urgency that's in the Chicago controller's terminology.
Yeah.
I don't see this word dominating the frequencies. I don't see any of that kind of stuff.
Well, that bothers me anyway, because I know how you guys work. You got numerous frequencies.
Yeah.
You don't dominate a frequency to the point where it's critical. We have to get everybody out for that reason.
We say, back to the area logs, that the pilot was asked to call the what we refer to as our E-desk, which just means it's the area manager's position when he landed. And that pilot did, and they asked that pilot to call me the next morning, and I did talk to him, and he reconfirmed it was an airplane and everything else. I then began to, if you will, dissect the Chicago controller's statement.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's ingrained into me. It's the nature of the beast. That is my job here, is
yeah.
to take an incident and to break it down so that each individual step becomes understandable. The fact that this fellow identifies himself as a radar air traffic controller.
That was unusual.
That's strange.
It's air traffic controller.
Uh-huh. Now, as we go through our process of training people, when they are in any form of training, we call them developmental. When they secede or accede to the highest level of control, we call them full performance, or FPL. Those are the commonly used terms. When this guy says he is a radar air traffic controller, it lends me to the position that he's still in a developmental status.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard that term used before. Have you?
Radar controller?
Yeah, radar air traffic controller.
Yeah, it's a...
Is that a loose term? Or
it's a credibility thing, I believe. That if I were to walk up to you on the street and say, hey, I'm an FPL controller at Indianapolis.
Yeah.
You would say, what the hell's an FPL
controller? I definitely would.
Yeah, but if I were to say, I'm a radar controller at Indianapolis, you would say, oh, okay, I can visualize what you do now. So that's probably where that's used.
Oh, okay.
We went on down to talk about the very busy times with the departures, and that he was dismayed at Indianapolis Center. Due south of him was rerouting their normal traffic. Now, those were some key words to me, rerouting and normal. Rerouting in our business, you're down where, North Vernon?
Mount Vernon, down there by Evansville.
Okay.
We got to come
up to Indy, and you normally take Highway 41.
Yeah.
But because there's some problem with 41, you decide to come up 67.
Mm.
That, to me, is rerouting.
Yeah.
Normal traffic, another key word. So we got a specialist here, a fellow that does nothing but manages the traffic flows for our facility. And I talked to him about this particular incident, and we went to the books and we dug out some numbers. Again, relating when my supervisor was up here, remember you and I were talking and I had him up here?
Uh-huh.
He was answering questions.
Yes, sir.
He felt that the situation was caused by a bunch of Detroit flights that entered our airspace that normally, and I can use that word, normally do not fly this southern route. That is a very, very distinct possibility as to have an impact on traffic. So I tried to lay out a scenario, and I worked with our traffic management guy down here, as to what the Chicago controller may have experienced. And I'm going to have to do this in a way that you can understand it. It's something I've lived with for 23 years when I start talking about these traffic flows, and if you get lost, you just throw out the anchor and we'll stop the boat.
All right.
I think the easiest way to visualize it is for you to take an imaginary blue cube and set it on your desk, and then on top of it, place an imaginary red cube. Now, the function for Indianapolis on certain flights going north into the Chicago Center's airspace is to descend the airplanes so that when they enter Chicago's airspace, they enter the blue cube only.
Mm-hmm.
We call that a letter of agreement, and we send them out in writing, and it says that on all these certain flights, Indianapolis will make sure that they get to an altitude that they only go into the blue cube, and that way the red cube's traffic patterns are not affected by those flights. This particular time period, and it went on for about a week when the jet stream was weird, there were a bunch of flights traversing Indianapolis eastbound that we generally don't work. Those flights generally stay north of us in Chicago's airspace. When they came across eastbound, it affected my Indianapolis controller's ability to descend down to the blue cube. So there were definitely some flights during a one-week period of time. I can't tell you specifically if it was the second, that because of extra traffic in Indianapolis entered the red cube at Chicago. We kept them higher than routine. Now that might have been something that this controller was talking about.
Uh-huh.
See, I'm back to that normal traffic. Normally, he wouldn't see those guys. I would not call that a reroute, though.
Well, I think the key is in the wording.
Uh-huh.
First of all, I'm dealing with someone that, or we're dealing with someone, we don't even know if he's a reputable source. At least I haven't talked to Mark Rodiger yet. And the other thing is, it's second-handed through the supervisor that he has to the supervisor who allegedly said this in Indianapolis.
And that's the guy we had up here the day you and I talked.
Yeah. You know, what we normally have is a pilot that comes to us in confidence and tells us what happened. This is totally backward compared to what we're used to. If there had been something, I would have liked to talk to the pilot, but it looks like everything's sort of falling heavily on this credibility of the guy that
I went on a little further because there's some inference in here, and this is where the guy's, I don't know if it's knowledge or credibility, begins to wane a little bit more. He makes a statement here that you should ask for the tapes from the Sky and Wabash sectors.
Yeah. I thought that was unusual, too.
okay.
How would have he known what sectors, anyway?
That's pretty easy to do. Let's go back to our cubes. Our blue cube is the Indianapolis sector.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like a county in the state of Indiana.
Yeah.
Above that cube, I'm going to give the Indianapolis sector a specific altitude limit for the sake of argument, from 24,000 to 33,000. That's the county in which that controller is responsible. Above that is our red cube, and that's the Wabash sector. And it goes from 35,000 to infinity. And that way I can segregate my traffic based on altitude, performance, and kind of split it up so that one guy's not overly taxed. The king sector is, if you will, the blue cube, and above it is the sky sector. So sky is what we call a super high. Wabash is a super high. And they butt right up against the Chicago boundary, so I'm sure that he has knowledge of it. That's no factor. Again, remembering from the logs now, the flight that encountered the unidentified aircraft was operating in the King sector. Blue cube, red cube dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Yet our guy from Chicago is worried about the Sky and Wabash sector. Now, this incident, if you will, and I'm going to put it in very loose quotes, occurred at the King sector. So Sky and Wabash really aren't dovetailed with it. I went and did some research with my traffic management people. Now, based upon what the Chicago controller's statement is that Indianapolis vacated their airspace, or that's an illusion that I get out of it. During the hour from 2300 to 0000, now we're talking Greenwich time, on the 2nd, 52 airplanes traversed the King sector. 56 airplanes traversed the Indianapolis sector. 36 airplanes traversed the Sky and Wabash combined sectors. Now, those were just numbers to me. So I asked the guy who's in charge down there, are these numbers high? Are these numbers low? Are they typical? Tell me what the volume is. Tell me what those numbers said. And he said he felt that the King number was a little high. The Indianapolis number was more than a little high, but not bonkers. And that the Wabash Sky combined number showed a little bit low. I said, okay, just for the hell of it, give me 1 week later on the same night. And those figures were King 54, Indianapolis 41, Sky Wabash combined, 45. So what he told me was pretty close. Now, I could do that for every Thursday and, you know, come up with an average. Those numbers of airplanes that that guy worked during that 23-00 hour would indicate to me that we were on a normal to a heavy traffic profile. So I don't see where this information from the Chicago guy that we diverted all the traffic away from us has any credibility at all.
Well, I expect Mark Rodiger to find out that he can't reach this guy, or either that, when he talks to him, he'll find out he's not a credible source.
Okay, now come on down another line where it says that he would like you to get the radar data, which he's calling the words, the letters ENTAP. That is not an acronym that we use. Our acronym is just NTAP. However, if I were to say to you, order an NTAP, how would you spell it?
Yeah, but see, he put it on the wire. He typed it in. That's what makes it. If he was telling someone who put it on the wire, which, you know, we may find out that that's exactly what happened, but the way it's presented on the printout looks like he typed it, but we may find out in the process, if we get to talk to the guy, that he told someone and someone put it on a wire.
Okay, somebody decoded it.
Yeah. I see what you're saying, though.
Those are some of the inconsistencies I find with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that this guy's, if in fact he did it, is not telling you what he believed to be the situation. I'm saying that the facts just don't bear it out. So I think on your sliding scale back there, you'll have to adjust for dilution or fabrication or enthusiasm, maybe.
Well, we've got some. Someday, when I get the chance, I'll send you what we consider a good report, either by airline or
okay, and
military.
I had another thought, too, and I don't know if it's of any validity to you. The department here allows me to go around and talk to various different groups. Normally, they're related to air traffic.
Right.
Do you have local meetings, get-togethers, sit-downs of a group of folks?
No.
Okay. Because what I was going to offer to do was to come and try to share with you how our air traffic system works. To see if that would give your investigators a little better basis for truth.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I wish that we could have done it so we could have videotaped and used it part of our training program. But we just don't. We usually have an annual meeting, and we've already had ours, and we bring in some of our experts to tell us what's going on in different parts of the world. But basically, our training's done in the field and through the mail and that sort of thing.
Okay. Well,
I appreciate that. I really do.
Those presentations are more important to the folks that you're dealing with.
Is there
kind of a bounce off the side deal here, a tangent.
Is there anything available in the videotape in the training?
No.
Probably isn't, because it's
nothing that would be condensed and
where we'd understand
broken
it.
Broken down into layman's terms, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, when I start talking about circular polarization, and by all means I am not a radar technician. All I am is a user of it. But over the years, I've been able to understand that when we're in a certain configuration, I expect certain things back.
Now, we have a couple people here in this corner, this little pocket area, that are with Evansville Dress Regional.
Okay.
That can help us on the technical ends, but I just
didn't know. They use a different radar system than we do.
Oh, yeah.
Theirs is ASRS.
Yeah.
And they paint primary targets. By definition, skin paint, reflected, highway patrol radar, where it bounces off of something and comes back.
Yeah.
In addition, they use transponder reinforced radar.
Right.
Here at the center, we have multiplicity of systems. Our three primary units, and that's a bad word, our three most pronounced units give us both. They'll give us primary and secondary. But then we supplement that to give us altitude coverage by ones that only work with transponders. And that's where this guy was. He was coming off the site that's located down at Huntingburg, Indiana. and it's a secondary radar only. But we've got rules now in the system that you cannot operate above 12,500 feet unless you have an operational transponder.
Mm-hmm.
And
Did you say that this unidentified aircraft had a transponder that wasn't working or what?
We would have no way of telling if he in fact did have a transponder. What we can say with a pretty good amount of surety is that there was no transponder reply being sent.
Mm-hmm.
The query that I gave the computer was to give me all targets in this specific range.
Now on your radar, you get an actual number on your display, don't you?
Transponder.
That's what I say. But here we get a double slash, don't we, on the radar here?
Very perhaps, yes.
Yeah.
That's an older system that we had years ago.
In fact, I'll tell you what, they've changed that and they've invited me up there, but I was up there probably in 1976 when Close Encounters, the movie, came out, and we went through the tower and they showed us the radar, and they've improved all that.
Oh,
I just haven't.
Yeah, it's changed a bunch.
Yeah.
What that used to be, in layman's terms again, is pretty much a raw radar display.
It's almost like the old military stuff.
Exactly. Now, they have changed that now where the raw information goes into a computer. And if the computer can correlate the transponder code with a flight plan, then there's electronic titling
mm-hmm.
placed in conjunction with that image.
Yeah.
I've never worked at a post control facility, so they may have some variance to it, but ours here is done in that fashion. And it's an interesting thing. I'm trying to think of the kid's name, Trester.
Oh, yeah.
I think his dad's name is Al, and he is Vern, over there at the tower.
Yeah, in fact, I talked to, I think his first name's Mark. And then we've got another guy that's one of our members. And then there was a gentleman that I met when I first came to town in 1973, trying to think what his name was. Very cooperative, very nice fella. I'm trying to seem like it was not McDonald, but something like that, you know.
Yeah, Bobby Bauer, of course, been the chief down there for off and on for about 10,000 years. So,
I've always been interested in what they do. I don't think I'm quick enough to ever learn to do it, but I've always been fascinated by radar. In fact, I'm in the detection end, and I study more of the hard stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I've always been fascinated by radar cases, especially radar visuals. And also the uncorrelated targets where no one sees anything, but yet it occurs during a peak period. In fact, the best cases we've got on record are military reports, you know, the Air Force and such, where they picked up stuff on radar. That's what got me involved in this. I wasn't impressed with civilian sightings. In fact, that's why people who read civilian sightings all the time never really understand what the problem is.
Uh-huh.
When you look at the military, where they had the radar and people that are, and of course law enforcement officers, where you've got people trained to write down what they see as quickly as they can. And
I run a little business on the side. I've been doing that now for over 20 years, and one of my employees is a retired sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And when this thing all came to be, you know, a week, 10 days ago, I was talking to him about it, and he said, yeah, they were on patrol one night. They very definitely had an unexplainable situation where, you know, the cars quit and the lights went out and all kind of stuff.
That always fascinated me.
Heavy electromagnetic. And this is a guy I trust with my cash register, so I'm going to damn well believe what he tells me.
Well, one night we were watching TV, and the phone kept ringing. And the dimmer lights that you don't normally touch, you know, to get to come on in the living room,
uh-huh.
kept going on and off. And my kids came running in the front door. This is probably 2 or 3 years ago. And they told me to come out and look at this thing. And I ran out to the front and looked down. It looked like a Christmas tree on the side. And it was on Victor 4. It looked like it was headed from Evansville to St. Louis. And I got on the phone, which was a portable wireless type phone, and called the tower direct. And it's funny, their number is 8120 and mine's 3120, so it was easy to remember. And they weren't painting anything. And whatever this thing was really weird, because it was putting out some type of disturbance. And I've always been impressed by those type of things.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, they don't usually happen to me. They usually happen to someone else, and then you've got to go back to like what we're doing. If no matter how good it sounds, if the source doesn't appear to be credible, You've got nothing.
And, well, you guys got my number, and if you get anything that's in our backyard, hell, you feel free to give me a holler.
Yeah. In fact, what I would like to do, I've got some older cases that one of them is rather thick, and one of the guys that works with us is prior Air Force. He put this man through the mill. In fact, I was ashamed to think that this guy almost had the man crying. I mean, he went too far. But the guy was telling us something happened there right at the airport, and it was right coming in on like approach. And my guy grilled him just like the military would have grilled a pilot. And we still think it's a hoax, but I might pass that on to you and have your comments on it.
Be happy to look at it.
Because we've written it off. It's a rather thick report, but my guy says he thinks the guy's actually hoaxing the thing.
All I've ever found is, as a kid, I remember a blue fireball at a low altitude go over the house and just hauling ass. That's as close to anything weird's ever happened to me.
Hello?
Yeah, Mark?
Yes.
Yeah, Francis.
Right, thanks for getting back. Well, I reached, turns out it's his home number, actually in downtown Chicago. But he does work out at the Aurora Center. And he didn't want me to tape it, but it was a short conversation in any case, so I have all the details there. Because the key thing is that he is the Stephen Taylor who put it on Prodigy. At least he said, I couldn't prove he was an air traffic controller, but he seemed to know what he was talking about. And he, in fact, he said as far as he knows, there are no FAA regulations against it, doing what he did. But he also chuckled when he said that, so he isn't absolutely sure. But he basically only added a few more details to what was on his Prodigy post.
But he didn't back down on anything.
Oh, not at all. No, he wasn't. I mean, he was surprised I called, but he wasn't upset I called. In fact, he said he was glad to hear somebody was looking into it.
If he only knew.
Yeah, exactly. He said that the sector and the area it was happening in was above 35,000 feet. And so, he thought that was interesting. And I also asked him how long the event happened. He said at least half an hour. And neither of those facts were on the Prodigy, printout.
Yeah.
And he said it was, very unusual because of the traffic rerouting. And he said that's how he knew about it. It wasn't that people were talking about a UFO sighting or anything. It was simply that he was working, particular sector, between Chicago and Indianapolis, and he was getting a tremendous amount of traffic through it that normally would have gone to Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know why, and then at 5:30 or 6:30 or something later in the day, 6:30 or so, supervisor came down and said, well, here's what was happening. Now, the third important detail that he mentioned is that there were two things going on as far as he knew. There was a minor airline emergency, and there was this UFO sighting from a private pilot. And they were both going on simultaneously down near Indianapolis.
So this, I'm surprised they didn't bring up the minor emergency. But
yeah,
it was a private pilot?
Yes, it was a private pilot, he thought. But again, see, the difference is, he never, private jets fly at 40,000 feet, so this doesn't surprise me, But he never, but he wasn't positive. He was good about saying, well, I don't know because my supervisor told me this.
Really, all he knows is what he was told anyway.
Exactly. That's right. That's number one. He was not involved with it directly. And number two, he wasn't able to ask around about it because it's not the kind of thing you ask around about.
Uh-huh.
So I think except for the additional few details I gave you, the height above 35,000, it lasted at least 30 minutes and so forth. I think you got everything on his Prodigy thing.
Yeah.
Output.
Well,
my
main concern was he real?
Yeah, he's real. He sounds, I had no indication he was lying.
Yeah.
And he sounds like he really does work there.
Yeah. Now, I sent a copy of a letter, or sent a letter to Robert, and then a copy of it to you and Walt, and it mentions in there that a couple of things. For